I'm Abigail Galvan. Welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
This was another example of the Biden-Harris administration trying to force their pro-abortion agenda onto pro-life states.
A push to change a state's strong pro-life law fails when it reaches the Supreme Court.
We're going into an election right now with a constitutional amendment that could change all sorts of aspects of Missouri law, roll back all sorts of safety requirements.
Strong protections for the unborn could be reversed in Missouri. How the church is working to inform voters.
I'm an organ donor myself, though I'm increasingly uneasy with that decision, frankly.
A controversial method of organ transplantation is on the rise. A look at the ethical concerns and what Catholics should consider before becoming a donor.
They let that Fifth Circuit decision in favor of the pro-life laws remain in effect.
A pro-life law in Texas that protects doctors from being forced to perform abortions will remain in place after the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal. Justices kept in place a lower court order that says hospitals cannot be required to provide abortions that would violate the state law. The Biden administration had asked the justices to throw out the lower court order, arguing the hospitals have to perform abortions in emergency situations under federal law. Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America State Policy Director Katie Daniel, says she hopes that the move provides clarity for medical professionals that no state law prevents action in an emergency.
Every single state law, including all of our pro-life states, allow for a woman to have an abortion in a medical emergency if that is the last resort that's necessary. They also, however, say that as long as we can, we need to be protecting both mom and baby. And that's what the federal law calls for as well.
The court confirmed that there is no conflict between pro-life state laws and federal laws, which require care for both mother and baby. Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance says that a second Trump administration will seek out defunding Planned Parenthood. While speaking to reporters after a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania on Sunday, Vance said that the Trump campaign doesn't believe that taxpayers should fund late-term abortions. The Trump administration tried to remove $60 million in funding from Planned Parenthood in 2018, but it got held up in court and ultimately rolled back under the Biden administration. In her new memoir released on Tuesday, former First Lady Melania Trump, a Catholic, reveals she supports abortion.
There is no room for compromise when it comes to this essential right that all women possess from birth, individual freedom. What does my body, my choice really mean?
In a post on X, she says individual freedom is a fundamental principle. Excerpts from her memoir say that it is imperative that a woman be able to make her own choice about having children, free from intervention from the government. The revelations sparked outcry from pro-life leaders. Melania says her husband has known of her position on abortion since they met. The six-week heartbeat law in Georgia, which prohibits abortion after 6 weeks, has been reinstated. The Georgia Supreme Court overturned a trial court judge's ruling on Monday in a 6-1 ruling. The pro-life law will remain while the court considers an appeal. A state with some of the strongest pro-life laws, Missouri, could see those protections for the unborn reversed this November. Voters will decide on enshrining abortion in the state constitution as a so-called right. It comes after a legal tug-of-war of whether or not it was even going to appear on the ballot. Those legal battles led up to the state Supreme Court, which supported the measure to appear on the ballot this November. Abortion is currently illegal in Missouri, except in cases of medical emergency. Jamie Morris, the executive director of the Missouri Catholic Conference, joins us now to talk about what they are doing to get the word out about this vote. Jamie, some pro-life advocates say this amendment was rushed and that it is not truly informing voters of all the laws that it would repeal. Can you explain?
Yeah, so we have a requirement in Missouri that initiative petitions must, when you're taking signatures for initiative petitions, they must show what
sections of the law or constitution are going to be repealed. And so there was some litigation on that in the state. And unfortunately, the pro-life side lost on that. But part of why those requirements are in place is that when you have a large constitutional amendment, such as what we're facing with Amendment 3, it's so individuals know what's going to be changed. And so, you know, we're going into an election right now with, you know, a constitutional amendment that could change all sorts of aspects of Missouri law, roll back all sorts of safety requirements. And we just, you know, don't know that the individuals are being properly informed about this.
To that point, what are you doing to inform voters of this initiative?
Sure. We are, you know, engaging our priest, you know, giving them the tools in which they can preach about this issue. We're going out and talking at parishes, putting information, you know, whether it's in bulletins or with different pro-life ministries throughout the state. And just, again, trying to equip the individual parishioners to be able to go and talk about this amendment with their friends and family and those they're around. Because, again, a lot of people don't know what Amendment 3 is going to do.
Yeah, and to provide some context for our viewers, could you explain what the pro-life movement and support looks like in Missouri?
Yeah, we are a very strong pro-life state, and so we have a lot of organizations along with the church in Missouri trying to fight back against Amendment 3, getting information out, running ads. And so it is a good unified effort. But we know we're going to be outspent quite a bit on this campaign.
And Jamie, real quick to close, do you think it will pass?
I'm leaning more toward yes, only because until a state defeats one of these amendments. But no, I think if any state has a chance, I think Missouri does. We're a very strong pro-life state. I think once individuals learn about the dangers of Amendment 3 and what it will do and what it will roll back for women's health, I think they tend to come to our side.
That's great. Thank you so much, Jamie Morris, for joining us today.
Thank you.
And don't forget to check out the Catholic News Agency's interactive map on state abortion ballots. Head over to CatholicNewsAgency.com and scroll to the bottom. San Francisco Archbishop Salvatore Cordeleone is urging people to vote no on a city proposition that he says targets two licensed pro-life medical facilities. The measure would require signs be placed in front of pro-life pregnancy centers stating that they do not provide a full range of reproductive rights simply because they don't perform abortions or refer for abortions.
If it becomes law, Proposition O would endanger the employees, volunteers, patients, and clients of life-affirming, state-licensed health clinics, because by singling out facilities that refuse to perform abortions, it potentially opens them up to abusive behavior by opponents.
Mississippi Attorney General Lynn Fitch, who led the Dobbs case which overturned Roe v. Wade, has requested an execution date for the state's oldest and longest-serving death row inmate. Richard Gerald Jordan was convicted in 1976 for the kidnapping and murder of a woman. He was accused of collecting a ransom from the woman's husband. Mississippi Supreme Court has rejected 78-year-old Jordan's latest appeal. Fitch wants an execution date within 28 days. South Carolina is ramping up capital punishment after a 13-year pause. The state Supreme Court set a date for November 1st to take the life of Richard Moore, who is accused of murdering a store clerk 25 years ago. This is the second of six expected executions in about 6 months. The 59-year-old inmate plans to ask South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster for mercy. No South Carolina governor has ever granted mercy in the modern era of the death penalty. The Department of Health and Human Services is working to modernize the organ transplant system in the United States for the first time in 40 years. They will move away from a single vendor to multiple vendors to support the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network, also known as OPTN. OPTN has faced criticisms for years about a lack of transparency, potential for conflicts of interest, IT reliability issues, and more. Several contractors will now provide expertise to improve patient safety and policy compliance systems, communication systems, and transparency, as well as IT and management systems. More than 46,000 organ transplant surgeries were performed in the United States last year alone. Of the major organs that are given, including lungs, hearts, and liver, the kidneys are the most needed and the most transplanted organ.
The donation of an organ can be considered a great act of charity. However, the church also maintains the importance of bodily integrity, that the person donating the organ is doing so voluntarily and is not putting their own health at risk.
According to organdonor.gov, more than 103,000 people in the United States are on a transplant waiting list right now. Every 8 minutes, another person is added to that list. And every day, an estimated 17 people in the U.S. die waiting to get an organ. In an effort to prevent deaths, a concerning organ transplant process has emerged. It's called normothermic regional perfusion, or NRP for short. Leading ethicists say NRP crosses a line and is unnecessary because other methods are available.
Unfortunately, it kind of sacrifices ethics to make more organs available.
Normal thermic regional perfusion, or NRP, is a new controversial organ transplant process. It involves declaring a patient dead based on cardiac criteria after their heart stops beating for between 2 and 5 minutes. Machines then reestablish circulation, but doctors clamp off the arteries, which would bring oxygenated blood to the brain. Doing so ensures that the brain dies, which arguably fulfills the letter, but likely not the spirit of the law. This facilitates organ harvesting, but possibly compromises ethical norms, because a doctor has actively participated in the brain death and did not allow the brain to die naturally. And therein lies the concern.
It's very important to maintain in transplant ethics the inviolability of that dead donor rule. You've got to be dead first. We have to have independent criteria to determine that death has occurred. And then we can try to harvest organs. And then, you know, we could try to do things to make sure that those organs are of high quality. But we can't use the procedure of harvesting organs to cause the death of the patient.
During a typical organ transplant, the donor must die naturally, which, according to current legal standards, requires the irreversible cessation of all brain or circulatory functioning. Once the body dies, the organs begin to sustain damage from lack of oxygen as well. There is a race against time to get them into a new body. Organs can be flown for miles on ice and rushed into a hospital to save someone's life.
So the most amazing experiences I had in medical school involved assisting on organ transplant procedures, particularly a liver transplant that I assisted on, which is just a really extraordinary, life-affirming and life-saving procedure. So if done right, if done well, if done in a way that's ethically acceptable, organ donation is a beautiful gift of life.
According to the Cleveland Clinic, researchers say NRP is used to preserve organs for a longer period of time, potentially being able to modify them with nutrients and medicine and to reduce the organ donor shortage. But critics like Dr. Joseph Meany, senior fellow at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, and Dr. Aaron Cariotti, director of the Bioethics and American Democracy Program at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, argue it is sacrificing one patient for another.
Say, look, it is better to save three lives by sacrificing one, you know, and it's better to do an evil so that more good will come from it. Now, that it goes completely against normal ethical thinking, sort of Catholic bioethical thinking, Catholic moral theology, where you're never allowed to do evil that good may come from it.
No sane person would argue we should take a perfectly healthy five-year-old girl and kill her in order to harvest her organs, because if we take several of her organs, maybe we could save the lives of four or five other five-year-olds who are on an organ recipient list and might die if they don't get an organ. And look, she happens to be a perfect match for all of them. And that kind of utilitarian logic just wouldn't fly. Well, we don't want to slip into that form of argumentation when we're talking about a procedure like this. We have to maintain the criteria that we cannot kill people, even if it does good for other people, Therefore, the dead donor rule has to stay in place.
Both bioethicists argue that alternatives to NRP should be practiced in hospitals.
Normothermic machine perfusion. So you declare a patient dead by cardiorespiratory or by brain death criteria. You harvest the organs, you take the organs out. There's no need to clamp the vessels to the brain. Circulation is not restarted while the organs are in the body. The heart is not restored to functioning while it's in the body. You take them out, then you hook them up to a machine that continues to oxygenate them outside of the body.
There's some exciting new research that is being done right now into growing organs. It could be possible that in the future, instead of having to transplant organs from other people, we could actually grow organs from the person's own cells. And that would be a wonderful thing.
Charles Camosi, professor of medical humanities at Creighton University School of Medicine, has written several articles about organ transplantation. He joins us now to dive a little further into this topic. Charles, how widespread would you say the controversial technique NRP is used to harvest organs?
Well, it's hard to say what percentage of organ transplants involves NRP, but at least in my experience, in both secular and Catholic discussions of medical ethics, frankly, this issue doesn't get discussed very often. And that's one reason I'm so glad you guys are engaging it, because it really does need to be discussed.
Okay. We know the church in principle is supportive of organ donations, but there is a lot of gray area, particularly when it comes to declaring someone brain dead. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, I'm an organ donor myself, though I'm increasingly uneasy with that decision, frankly, after everything I've learned over the last several years studying this issue, engaging on this issue. And you're right, there is a lot of gray area. In fact, there's going to be a major conference at the Catholic University of America this coming February, actually, with the National Catholic Bioethics Center. I'll be speaking at it along with some other folks, which is engaging in particular brain death. So we go all the way back to the 60s and 70s when we first started talking about brain death as death. It was a Harvard ad hoc committee on brain death, which declared that the case, and all 50 states sort of followed after soon after that. Unfortunately, the reason why they declared brain death as death was precisely because they wanted more organs. So they were very upfront about that. We need to declare brain death as death so we can get more organs for people using the dead donor rule. And especially now, my gosh, we have serious debate about whether this is the case. We've had brain individuals gestate children to birth. We've had brain dead individuals get their first period. Brain individuals fight off infections, react to bodily trauma by releasing adrenaline and heart rate increasing. So there's lots and lots of questions to ask about this, including the fact, I'll just finish with this, the American Academy of Neurology has said, you know what, maybe the whole brain doesn't need to be dead. Maybe who cares if the brain stem is actually functioning or the hypothalamus is actually functioning. So effectively, we might be, in those circles anyway, moving away from the brain death standard to a partial brain death standard.
That's very troubling to hear. And Charles, you speak to many medical professionals who are on the front lines when organs are being harvested and transplanted. What do you hear from them on the ground?
Well, I hear lots of things. I hear in particular the sense that we might be returning to a kind of utilitarian sort of let's just decide that people are dead because of the ability to get organs. And again, I'm here to say we probably, lots of people watching, maybe have people alive in their own very close circles who are alive because of organ transplant. I know I do. But we're, especially as Catholics, we're not just straight up no chaser consequentialists about this, right? There are certain things, we can't just round up homeless people and get organs, for instance, right? These have to be governed by severely imposed defenses of human dignity. And if we are just being utilitarian about this, which again, it seems like we might be sliding towards in a very particular way, boy, oh boy, that's a unfortunate direction, as you may have mentioned earlier.
No, you're right. So what should Catholics be taking into consideration when discerning whether or not to be an organ donor?
Well, I think there's got to be a lot of prayer at this point. That's number one, a lot of discernment. These are new questions for many people, at least when I was growing up as a pretty, you know, down the line Catholic, it was just a matter of course that, of course, you would be an organ donor. But with these new questions, these new practices, these new principles that are at the heart of this, I think maybe prayer. I'd also maybe talk to people in your lives and make it clear with them what, if you have particular views, what your views are. It may be more auspicious to take yourself off the DMV sort of checkbox thing and maybe have your own document that says, I would like to donate in this situation, but not this situation, or only after this number of minutes after cardiac arrest, or I don't want the perfusion procedure. I just come back to prayer. I think especially if you're confused about this, as frankly I am, I think we need to bring a lot of this to prayer and to God.
You can't go wrong with prayer. Charles, is there anything else you'd like to add that you think people should be aware of?
Yeah, there's another way that people are declared dead, and it's not just through brain death, it's through the fancy phrase is cardiopulmonary standard. Mm-hmm. That just means people who have stopped breathing and their hearts have stopped. And frankly, we now stop about between 2 and 5 minutes, or after 2 or 5 minutes of cardiac arrest and the stoppage of breathing, we take organs out. Which for me, from my perspective, is not any indication that you have died. In fact, if I often joke with my students, if I just plop down on the ground in front of them and the EMTs come after 5 minutes, I hope you don't declare me dead, right? Please, like, ask them to work on me. So that might be another thing you also talk to your friends and family about, that you put in some kind of legal document. What is an appropriate number of minutes to wait? That'd be another thing to think about, too.
Thank you so much, Charles, for being with us today. And thank you for the work that you do informing and educating people. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
When we return, the Holy Father's message to married Catholics. And we are getting closer to the March for Life, and organizers have released the theme of the 2025 March. That story to you when we return. Welcome back to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. We are about 3 months away from the annual March for Life in Washington, D.C. And on Thursday, leaders released the official theme of the 2025 March. That theme is Every Life, Why We March. Jeannie Mancini, president for the March for Life, hopes the theme encourages the pro-life movement amid confusion about abortion and upcoming ballot initiatives.
2.5 years after the overturn of Roe, that there are many who need to be reminded of the importance of, like, every sacrifice, of every act to build a culture of life. It really does make a difference. And we're living in a particular moment in history, which is the cultural reverberation of the earthquake of the overturn of Roe. And it's so, I mean, to lean into that, to know, you know, being that one little light in a dark room, it makes a huge difference. So we want to do everything possible to encourage people in that direction.
Mancini says this theme is going back to the basics about the March for Life's purpose. EWTN is your home for complete coverage of the March for Life. This year, it will be held on Friday, January 24th. We will bring you on-the-ground reports from the rally and throughout the march, as well as provide analysis from pro-life experts throughout the day. Our coverage begins at 9 a.m. Continuing his advocacy for life, Pope Francis urged married couples during his Angelus last Sunday to be open to the gift of having children. He asked couples to really reflect on if their marriage is fully open to such a blessing.
They are the most beautiful fruit of love, the greatest blessing from God, a source of joy and hope for every home and all of society. Have children. Have children.
Fate figli.
The Pope recalled a member of the Vatican's Gendarmerie Corps brought his 8 children to a mass in St. Peter's Basilica the day before, and how beautiful it was to see that family together. That does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Be sure to like and follow us on our social media channels. You can find us at EWTN Pro-Life on X, Facebook, and Instagram. And sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse, EWTN.com/pro-life. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.